The following episode was recorded in January 2015. Happier times.
Bonjour et bienvenue à l'épisode numéro 29.
Hello and welcome to episode number 29
of Season to Taste. Google Translate there, isn't that fun? Well, hello, this is Season to Taste. This is a Doctor Who podcast with, in a timey-wimey fashion, the distance between episodes getting longer and longer and longer. In this podcast, we watch one Doctor Who story as a representative of its season, and we see how it is, and then we pick another one. We've done 28 previous episodes, which means we've done 27 stories. Mm-hmm. So, in episode 28, we decided to watch The Mask of Mandragora. Matt, what did you think of Doctor Who and the medieval homoeroticism?
Well, obviously I'm a big fan of medieval homoeroticism.
Obviously.
And of, I guess, homoeroticism in general. But
And medievalism in general.
And medievalism in general. So it combines, it's like fish fingers and custard, it combines
all of your interests
all
together.
Of my interests in one delicious, sticky, fishy tasting bowl.
And yet somehow, and you may disagree, but somehow I kind of think not really as great as the sum of its parts.
Would you say it's a triumph of style over substance?
I wouldn't say it's a triumph of anything.
I said while we were watching it that Louis Marx is kind of good at high concept stories, so thinking about the other things that he's done, Planet of Giants, they're all small, in obviously Day of the Daleks, it's timey-wimey and they're in two different time zones. This one, he's taking the clash between the religion and superstition in Renaissance Italy and making it into a real life kind of clash between an alien, superstitious cult, weird thing, and the Doctor's kind of rational, scientific approach.
And, you know, credit to Louis Marx for writing three very, very different stories.
Exactly. So I love the concept of it. I think it's an astonishing, really hitting the nail on the head of what Doctor Who was becoming in the mid-70s, which was the Doctor was facing more and more horrific situations where things from the past, kind of superstitious, weird, demonic, ghostly forces from the past, from a period before rational thought and before
Things like the Fenderline and Sutek.
Yeah. I guess it all kicked off really with Azal, but
there's even like the creature in Planet of Evil.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of these weird, almost mythological creatures from
Kronos.
The horrific past coming into a rational, scientific present, and we've seen that with stuff like the demons, but here Louis Marx has kind of picked that as a theme that's coming out, and then he's bumped it back in time to the point where the modern world really started to come into being. So I think all credit to him. I think that's really powerful. I'm just not sure then the nuts and bolts of the story that he builds around the concept are quite good enough to sustain it for four episodes.
No, well, they're not. It doesn't have a plot that really feels like it's driving forward. It has a plot that feels like there is a lot of running around, getting knocked out, getting locked up, escaping. The Doctor, I don't even know to the extent the Doctor's really driving that story. It's more kind of just happening around him while he bumbles through. Sarah Jane is on form in terms of her sarcastic put-downs, but again, it just spends quite a lot of time kidnapped, tied up, chained up, not really actually doing anything active.
Yeah, I think I said to you in the first episode, that's a bit cheap, having the Doctor literally knocked out twice by different people in the space of 10 minutes. It, right from the outset, the story feels like it's going to be variations on a very limited number of themes. But I guess, again, that's maybe typical of the way that Louis Marx writes, because basically what is Planet of Giants other than they're small and now they're in lots of different situations where they're small and everything around them is a slightly different environment, but it's basically the same thing. They're small, it's big. That's the concept, and that's basically how the story develops. And eventually, Planet of Giants had to be edited down from four parts to three because there's only a very limited lifespan in that kind of concept.
But at least in that story, it's kind of the protagonists have been put in a different difficult situation. It's about them trying to then get out of it. Whereas it doesn't particularly feel like the Doctor and Sarah Jane are the protagonists in the story. It does quite a good job of creating the Renaissance world that they're in and the people vying for power in San Martino and the Duke and his uncle and the Duke's best friend, definitely just friends, Marco.
His companion.
They spend a lot of time together, very supportive. Those people are all sketched really well, almost to the detriment of the regulars, who are just kind of floating around. Even like Rossini, the guard, who I recognised as Bill Pritchard in Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, despite his beard. He feels like he has something to do in his kind of dilemma at the end about who to support. But they're having the plot, while the Doctor and Sarah are just kind of there.
Yeah, it is one of those stories where Sarah Jane really has nothing particularly interesting to do, and it's only Elizabeth Sladen's watchability and skill as an actor that makes it her in any way memorable, because there's nothing inherent in the writing that makes Sarah stand out particularly.
Hieronymus as well, of course, is a very memorable character with Norman Jones's. He plays Inspector Bell and Inspector Morse. Norman Jones's wild goggly eyes and ridiculously over-the-top pointy beard. And we talked about how we like the masks that the brethren wear.
Yeah.
They're quite scary. My problem with them...
Really creepy, yeah.
Yeah, they're very creepy looking.
Especially, actually, not even the masks that they wear for all their brethren stuff, although those are very good. The bit that I actually did get a bit of a shiver down the spine at was in the final mask sequence where they have the kind of sheep head and the kind of weird animal faces.
It turns into like
it's all red lit. It's suddenly really...
It feels like an orgy for My Claudius that point.
It's like something right from a 70s horror film.
And yet, yeah, the masks look really good. However, you take a load of actors who, you know, do good face acting, and then you stick these completely plain masks with no eye holes, no mouth holes, and suddenly everyone's voice is held back behind the mask. You don't get as much of the performance through. And poor old Hieronymus, once he's been basically absorbed into the Mandragora thing at the end, and we get that Saffron Steel moment of his non-face being revealed, or Omega moment of his non-face being revealed, Norman Jones doesn't get to do any face acting at all for the whole last episode.
Oh, I can't see, I noticed.
And he does, that was a problem. He does good booming voice acting as well. I found there was just slightly too many bits where I actually wanted to see the characters' faces. That said, the guy playing the High Priest looks like a university English literature professor. He's the one person who you kind of look at and go, are you really from 16th century Italy?
Yeah, he kind of looks like he's styling himself after John Pertwee a bit, doesn't he? With the kind of big, white, fluffy hair.
He later turns up in Century Falls.
70s. He's got very 70s kind of face and hairstyle.
He's got aquiline, yeah. He turns up in Century Falls, Russell T Davies's 93 children's series, which also has this kind of mask, gold mask motif going on. I thought that the setup of the world was quite interesting. Again, that's kind of part of that, the ideas that Louis Marx brought in. It reminded me a lot of Tara, partly, obviously, because of those kind of...
Tara King.
Androids of Tara. because of those costumes, which are obviously the same kind of era, and having, you know, a power struggle for a feudal community. Where it was better than Tara is that I know one of my complaints when we watched that was they talk about ruling, but you don't really give any talk at all about the people who are there. You still don't see that much in the way of people, but there is at least a hint there is a community in San Martino. There are people you have to get on side. It's not just about guards. It's just that even in a tokenistic way, it feels like a more real ground. Maybe it's just because it's on Earth, but it feels like a more grounded setting, and that it actually matters who runs the place. Also because, I mean, we said it with Tara, you kind of got the idea it's one kind of feudal dictator or another, it's just one of them seems nicer, whereas in Mandragora you have the kind of superstitious count versus the science of the Duke, and that actually means there is a real difference in outcome depending who takes charge.
I don't know that the count is superstitious. I think he thinks that it is all a load of old nonsense. However, he's willing to let Hieronymus make his prophecies because it's a good way of controlling the population and furthering the Count's own political ambitions. I actually think that's really insightful writing by Louis Marx, because essentially the church or superstition in the 15th century, and I guess even today, is very much about social control to further the power of certain elites, isn't it? And And then you have the young prince, who is a Renaissance prince, who's much more a man of the people, who wants people to have access to learning and to new thinking and to new technologies. So I really did like that element. I think that's really, really powerful. And it's almost Hartnell historical-like, in that it's really trying to get to the nub of an era and to make it about a clash of cultures.
I think it's the first real historical story that Tom has. I mean, the Pyramids of Mars is obviously set in the 1910s, but yeah, that's kind of like the near past. And that setting is more about what everyone's wearing than any real, and the fact it ties into early Egyptology, whereas this is more about focusing on the era itself and being, you know, properly 500 years in the past. And yeah, it makes the setting very much part of the story.
But I think it's a level of depth of thinking about periods of history that is not apparent enough in a lot of other Tom Baker historical stories. I mean, you've mentioned Pyramids of Mars, but even stuff that you get later on. So try and pick one out of the air.
Oh, Rock is the only other one, isn't it?
Well, Talons.
Oh, Talons, of course, yes. Talons are very well the other two.
They're very kind of about Hammer horror and the trappings.
They're about using it for the style and the look.
It's very much more superficial. I mean, it's great. I love horror of Fang Rock, and I love Talons of Weng Chiang, but their view of history is much more superficial, and I'm not sure that there's any kind of deeper thinking about what does this actually mean. Yeah. I think even in the modern series, occasionally it's kind of touched on, but it's like, ooh, isn't the past a strange place where people do things differently, rather than really trying to understand what was this period of history all about, what were some of the forces of history at work, and how could you incorporate them into a not just a historical plot but also a science fiction plot that maybe plays off that play off each other.
Weng Chiang is playing off Jack the Ripper and Sherlock Holmes. Although it's an interesting use of science fiction with that, there's no real thematic link.
Yeah, it's literature rather than history.
Yeah, yes. Well, Jack the Ripper is history, but
and as much literature, really.
Yes, yes. It's about the fictional creations around it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So something that isn't in history, the kind of sci-fi element, we start in the TARDIS wandering around, seeing the CSO boot cupboard. Then we meet the new, stroke old, second control room,
which apparently was used by the second and third doctors.
Yeah, they left some of their
recorder in there, and the third doctor's kind of ruffled shirt and one of his actual velvet jackets. I mean, it looks like the one he wore in The Three Doctors.
And someone's been using the shaving mirror at some point. Maybe it was Jamie.
So I wonder if we're supposed to think this is the control room that he had to use while he was being controlled by the Time Lords, given that he would have used that up to the Three Doctors, because that's, I mean, the Second Doctor and the Third Doctor stuff's in there, and maybe once he got control back of the TARDIS, he moved back to the original control.
The Third Doctor's doing all that work in Season 7 on the console. You don't realise that there's a whole other console just sitting inside. In fact, he should have taken the dematerialisation circuit from the second console room, didn't even think of that.
So while we're on the subject of the secondary console room, what do you actually think of the set itself in comparison to the previous TARDIS sets? Because it is a very radical... They've redesigned the TARDIS set before, but never quite so radically.
In a way, I think they should... If they wanted to make it stick, they actually shouldn't have come up with the secondary console idea. They should have gone, I'm changing the design. And it's weird, because actually, you look and you go, my God, what were you thinking? Trying to get away from this iconic old look. And yet, now, you can look at the TARDISes and go, they're all very, very different now, and we're just happy that they look different every few years.
Yeah.
They still have the same basic structure. I always used to quite like it. I thought there was something quite romantic about it. I suppose there's something quite steampunky about it almost. Maybe there's not quite enough technology for it to be at that level. I don't know how much it's wood or just like it's some kind of plaster that looks like wood.
No, it was wood. Which is why it warped. The reason they got rid of it, it was in storage.
But yeah, it looked... I think I would be sad that if they'd never gone back to the other console. However, over the top in the 80s, it was looking in the 80s. But I've always quite liked it, and I think it's nice to have the change. I think the console's a bit too small. It always reminds me of a pub table.
Yes, it does. It looks like the ones they used to have in the Fitzroy Tower.
Yeah, I used to feel like they just
pretend you're in season 14.
You just need the shaving mirror and a recorder. The other thing I don't really like about it, which I didn't particularly notice in this story, but in other stories, when you exit and enter, you kind of go up some stairs to a bit that looks like a transporter from Star Trek, and then, or from Blake 7 actually, but then you kind of just go around the corner and go out. There's no idea that there's actually doors. It's like there's a little corridor running through to try and, there's no attempt to make put the doors there in the way that, again, the modern TARDISes go, no, we definitely always have the doors.
There's elements of it I like, and I think you're right, actually, on reflection. They now change the set every 4 or 5 years, and it keeps it fresh. So I get that. I think it's maybe just almost like too radical a departure. I really miss that. It sounds really pathetic and fannish, and I guess it is, but I miss the time rotor.
No, that's a very good point.
It's flying. I really hate the fact that the console doesn't have.
It shouldn't be. It doesn't even need
to be
that.
The main TARDIS console element.
I really like the thing in the Rani's TARDIS. There's two rings that just go around and look like they're going up and down, even though they're just turning. And even if it was just something like that in that space at the top of the console, but instead it looks like a desk.
Yeah, you won't often hear me saying this, but I think the TV movies take on, and I'm sure it is a take on this specific TARDIS set, is so much better than what they achieved in the Hinchcliffe era. And clearly had loads more money to spend, but I think they still get that kind of wood, brass, steampunky effect. But they also link it with a sense of size and scale.
The more recent consoles are far more like the TV movie than they are.
And the time rotor is a teeth cruncher.
Yeah.
And I think the last thing that I don't like about the secondary console room is it feels much more small and cramped than the big white one.
The whole thing feels like a study.
It's probably exactly the same size set. It's just because it's wood and because it's kind of got the stairs going up here, and it just looks more cramped. And the amazing thing about the original, particularly in, you know, something like The Unearthly Child, but in general, the thing about the white TARDIS set is it's like you've got this battered old tiny wooden box and you go in this huge white futuristic room.
Yeah, it doesn't
and
seem
it's
bigger
not
on the inside.
It's not the dichotomy where it's like a battered wooden box and you open it up and yes, it's bigger, but it's basically a wooden study.
Yeah, you have a battered wooden box with a wooden study inside. Well,
it's not quite
actually, the console maybe doesn't need to be that big, but the original console, the fact that it's big kind of says this is a powerful, important part of a machine that is, you know, ripping space-time apart. It isn't somewhere where you keep your correspondence.
I quite liked it because I'd forgotten quite how obvious it is that it's a continuity point, right, in that scene, that it's Tom holding the Third Doctor's shirt, his predecessor's shirt, and the big velvet jacket, and Liz Sladen playing on Patrick Troughton's recorder. And I think in the Hinchcliffe stuff, there's actually quite a few nods to the previous Doctors. I mean, you see their faces, obviously, in Morbius. There's going to be references to previous regenerations coming up in The Deadly Assassin. So I think Tom in the Hinchcliffe era is positioned much more as number 4 in a list of Doctors, and in the Graham Williams era, because maybe of his tenure and the fact that they haven't done any multi-Doctor stories, that starts to kind of fade a bit. I think in the Graham Williams stuff, I can't think offhand of many references to previous Doctors or previous eras, because they're all at that point very far in the past, aren't they?
Yeah, on the whole, Doctor Who just doesn't do that. Yeah, these
it things does it more and more as you go into the JNT stuff, doesn't it? And it did it a lot, to be fair, in the Barry Letts stuff. In Day of the Daleks, you see Hartnell and Troughton's pictures on the mind probe screen, and then you're in the three Doctors.
The same thing happens in Resurrection of the Daleks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's loads of clips of previous Doctors in things like Earthshock and Mordrin Undead. So I think the past is very present in both Barry Letts and John Nathan Turner stuff, and actually it's there as well in Philip Hinchcliffe. Yeah. It's almost like it was Graham Williams, who never had any experience of working with previous Doctors or previous companions or whatever. It was always just the Tom stuff that maybe just ingrained this Tom is the Doctor kind of thing.
Maybe, yeah. And then once they've settled in the console room, which it's a slightly odd way to open a story, because the Doctor doesn't arrive somewhere and find something going on. He actually kind of takes Mandragora to Earth himself, but he materialises in the Helix, which has this CSO backdrop, blown up crystals. It's all very kind of eerie and empty and echoey, oddly, for something which appears to be infinite. And yeah, it's there's a I think it's good, but it also is almost too odd to be engaging. And it does that thing I don't really like in Doctor Who, where the Doctor just goes, oh, it's the Mandragora Helix. There's no kind of investigation involved there. It's, oh, yep, and then I took it to Earth. And, you know, he never finds anything out. That's possibly why it feels like he isn't central to the story, because he doesn't get to Earth and have to work out what's going on. He pretty much knows he's caused it to begin with, and then just wanders around for 3 episodes waiting to fix it.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I was watching it thinking, in Pyramids of Mars, there's kind of that sense that he knows all about the Asirans, and he's the source and the font of knowledge rather than having to learn or investigate things. But I think that's just been the case in Doctor Who.
I mean, he knows who Magnus Greer is, which is fine, but he has to work out that it is Magnus Greer, at least. He doesn't just go, oh, he doesn't arrive and go, yes, it's him. We're told the word Mandragora in the opening credits, but then we're told it by the Doctor the moment he opens the scanner.
Yeah. And I think the Mandragora Helix in general is where I think the writing isn't quite right, because I think Marx is trying to get at this idea of the Helix as this ancient superstitious force, but it's never quite clear what it's trying to do and what the point of it is.
It's weird, the Doctor kind of describes it as having some kind of intelligence, but then when the red dot goes flying into the TARDIS at the beginning and the TARDIS dematerialises, there's just this kind of wah-ha-ha laugh, and you go, you can't have it both ways. You can't have like something that's so scary and mysterious it almost can't be anthropomorphised, at least until it takes over a person like Hieronymus. And then you've actually got, even when it's working with Hieronymus, you've just got this voice kind of booming down and explaining what it's, and actually, again, slowing down the scene, because it booms down very slowly to tell what it wants to happen. And what I wanted to happen was for it to just talk faster.
Although I was reminded of the snowmen and the great intelligence coming down, because there's this implication that Hieronymus is the reason why the Mandragora has chosen to go to Earth at that particular point.
He's starting
point.
To, his visions and things are starting to supposedly get more accurate even before it's, although that may be its influence going back in time as well as forwards, I suppose.
Could be, but that's never stated.
No, I think I would rather, actually, the Doctor hadn't taken it there, that the Doctor had landed there, and then found something going on, and it was the Mandragora Helix, and had been building up for a while, and then you can have that kind of, because actually, the implication is, he actually can predict the future.
Yeah, there's no real need, because it's not in a period of the show where the Doctor has any particular angsty characterisation. You can imagine if McCoy had been the one who'd taken it to Earth, that would be source of lots of scenes of ownership and responsibility and hand-wringing.
Being told that with Tom, by the companion.
Tom has like one throwaway line, oh, it's the Mandragora Helix and I brought it here. And he does it very well, but that's it. He doesn't seem to bear any guilt or responsibility.
He gets knocked out.
About all the people who die.
Yeah.
Just because on a whim he's decided to...
And on the upside they reward him with salami, so...
Massive salami, yeah.
As if it wasn't... If you choose to read the dialogue between Giuliano and Marco in certain ways, you can just make your own innuendo. You know, when Marco says, I shall not lie against the Duke, and you think, well, it wouldn't be the first time, would it? And then at the end, the doctor makes a joke about salami that just doesn't really work. And then in the next scene, he's actually holding a massive salami in as suggestive way that Tom can get away with without actually being suggestive with it. Sorry, I slightly went off the point, but I think we'd kind of exhausted the Mandragora Helix, hadn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't quite work for me. There is some good kind of design stuff. There's good. The thing is nicely made. The Port Merion location works well.
Oh, your first reaction is, oh, they're in Port Merion, but actually,
you barely then notice that.
That would be a very cynical view to hold all the way through the story. I think actually the locations, the kind of ruined temples.
It doesn't look like the village.
It's actually done very, very well, and it adds a real kind of extra layer to the look of the story.
There's that really gruesome blue corpse.
It's lingered on for quite a long time.
They presumably went, if we paint it blue and it's not actual blood, then we can just have a horrible, horrible corpse on screen for a while.
It's not just the fact that it's blue, it's the kind of hair on the top of it.
It looks like it's been burnt, it's just grim,
and bubbled face with just a head of hair.
The nicest bit of direction I saw was when the Mandragora Helix exits the TARDIS and is kind of looking around to see where to go, and there's like a handheld shot, as if it's kind of walking through the forest and looking around. And it's a really nice way of kind of almost, you're almost seeing it from Mandragora's point of view, which is a nice little touch. I didn't even notice who directed it. I think it was Rodney Bennett.
Oh, right.
I say I think, I literally just Googled that. Yeah, Rodney Bennett directed it. So that's a nice little touch from him. So the one other thing that I think we should talk about, I use this as an opportunity to discuss. The Doctor works out that Sarah has been drugged because she asks about the TARDIS translation system and the fact she can understand the locals.
Women asking questions.
I know, and his thing is...
must be
exactly. His thing is, well, you've never asked me that before, so I jumped to the conclusion you must have been drugged. Basically, his female companion asking a sensible question is what the Doctor interprets as being meaning she'd be drugged. Now, apart from the fact that that just isn't a very satisfying line and, plot, and plot thing, it does kind of lead me on to talk about, right, so Sarah Jane is basically the only named female character in The Mask of Mandragora. We are two stories away from The Deadly Assassin, the Doctor Who story, with no female characters at all anywhere on screen. And then you start to look at the Hinchcliffe era as a whole. I mean, you start to look at Doctor Who as a whole, but then you kind of centre in on the Hinchcliffe era and are going, well, what have we got in The Seeds of Doom? Well, we've got Amelia Ducotte and anyone else spring to mind? Brennan Morbius is all right. You've got the Sisterhood of Khan, but they are kind of... it's almost a thing that they're women over there having their separate plot. Android Invasion, there's not much in the way of women. There's maybe some people at desks.
Women who can't clean a chimney and who worship youth-making elixir.
Oh, the Sisterhood, yes. Must be young. The Planet of Evil, not really. Pyramids of Mars, again, Sarah Jane is the only named female character. Zygons, you've got the nurse, is it?
Yeah,
and there's a nurse in the Hand of Fear, but I struggle to. You know, Genesis isn't too bad. It's got
Aethal.
Yeah, Aethal. It's a Sontaran experiment. Don't even bother. Robot's got a female villain. Ark in Space has
Vira.
Terra,
the female Terra president.
The female president.
Sarah
but
Jane.
It's not exactly overwhelming the level of. Female characters in this bit, and then you kind of look a bit later and you go, well, actually, when you get down to you get into the next season, and if Robots of Death has a couple of female characters, which is good. Face of Evil has Leela and
a random background, a Tesh or lady. Something. They call the Tesh a bloke, so.
Prostitutes, basically, if you're in Talons, or you're at the theatre, but you're not a named character, then. And then we get into the next season, actually, Horror Fang Rock, we have.
Abigail, or something like that.
In the lighthouse, we have the several characters in Image of the Fendal. We have Rodan in Invasion of Time. Invisible Enemy?
Can't think of any in Invisible Enemy, but I think there are people on the...
And Underworld, I think there's a few. And then there are a lot more as you get into the Key to Time season. And eight, like something like the Keeper of Truck, and you've actually got loads of female characters. And it does feel... And you look back at the Purple Era, and it feels like there are more. I mean, even if sometimes they are the unit soldier answering the phone, you had actual unit soldiers. Now, it's difficult for a story like Mandragora, because as soon as you get into historical stuff where, like, the men are running things, it's trickier, and you've got... most of the supporting characters are guards, who in 16th century Italy are not going to be women. But even so, you look at something like the Time Warrior, the king has a wife, or the... Earl. Is he a king? The Earl.
Wessex.
The Earl of Wessex has a wife, off of EastEnders, who is playing a key role in the plot. And even if the women you have to introduce are wives, you can still do that. Maybe the Duke could be married, the Count could be married... He could be plotting with his wife. The astrologer could be a woman, actually. Maybe if you're actually going to have a brethren, they can't be. But, you know, you could do bits here and there. And it just feels symptomatic of the era. If this was the only story that was the case, that'd be one thing. But, yeah, you know, there's a choice not to have any women Time Lords in The Deadly Assassin.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's actually Robert Holmes who... It's not that he's not... He's not taking them out, but he's not actively pushing female characters in. You know, you not forget the Bechdel test and two female characters talking to each other about something other than the man. You just don't have... A lot of the stories don't have two female characters.
Yeah. Well, when Terence Dix was script editing, I know Terence holds, I think, slightly tongue-in-cheek views about women and sometimes says kind of sexist things, although I tend to think probably just as a wind-up. He did always, even in this Trout and stuff, he did get like people like Miss Garrett into scripts and... Mm. You know, the Crotons has got female rebels.
Well, the War Games has got female ambulance driver.
Characters, yeah. Lady Jennifer, isn't it?
Yeah, and you kind of look at some of these stories and go, they just don't need to be as male-dominated as they are. Particularly the things set on kind of spaceships in the future. You can actually... I know, you know, the 70s is not... The frustrating thing is, it feels like the Pertwee era and the Troughton era were doing better. So you can't just say, you know, it's all...
Or trying harder, if not doing better.
Yes, yeah, you know, it wasn't brilliant, but... And I'm not asking for tokenistic characters. I'm just saying, when you sit down, don't just go, right, you know, these are male writers sitting down just writing men and going, oh, yeah, they're on a spaceship, they must all be men, and just not even properly thinking about it. And, yeah, this story, I just suddenly went partway through. I've not seen any other women for Sarah Jane. And Sarah Jane is being really badly treated in the story as well. So, basically, this is a men's story, and with lots of men trying to outdo each other. You know, even the voice of the Mandragora Helix could have been female, if they'd wanted. So anyway, that's my slightly ranty comment on the air. Actually, saying, is the Hinchcliffe era the nadir for female representation in Doctor Who? Overall then, Mask of Mandragora, I, to be honest... did not enjoy it very much. I think I said last time that my one memory of it was not that it was bad, but that I was just quite bored by it, and I was still pretty bored by it.
I wouldn't say I was bored, but I wasn't gripped. I think
the script doesn't sparkle, which doesn't help.
No, it was decent. There was nothing particularly bad about it, but I think there's much stronger stories in that season, and I think there's much stronger stories within the previous season as well. So I'm still slightly baffled why Hinchcliffe picked that one above anything else to really recommend to JNT for the Five Faces of Doctor Who as the story that he would really like in the season.
I can see from a production side that you might feel that it's very well produced. You know, it's got good actors in it. It's got Tim Pigott-Smith, now Charles III in the West End, you know, very respected actor. And others among them as well. And yeah, I could see why from a production side you'd feel like you've made a really good
piece of work. It's a very solid piece of
costumes
work.
Costumes are very good, sets are very good, effects are pretty good.
Yeah. No, it's a very solid piece of work, but I don't think it stands any comparison to either Terror of the Zygons, Robots of Death, The Ark in Space.
Pyramids of Mars.
Not sure Pyramids of Mars is as great as it cracks up to be.
It's better than Mandragora.
It's better than Mandragora, yeah.
Yeah.
The Deadly Assassin is better than Mandragora.
Rebels of Death. It's not. It's in the lower part of this season, isn't it?
I think it's almost... Maybe picked it because it's like the most average of all of the Hinchcliffe stories. It's nowhere near as ropey as something like the Android Invasion. But it's also... nowhere near as inventive and clever as something like the Robots of Death.
But it's that odd thing, like the Android Invasions kind of still surprises you more, and there's almost fun to be had from how over the top some elements of it are. Whereas Norman Jones's goggle eyes aside, there's just not a lot of fun to be had from it. You're kind of just going,
this is medieval homoeroticism, that's quite fun.
Yeah, I suppose you can make your own fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is season 14. And that's Mask of Mandragora. So let us spin up the randomizer and find out which season to taste next. The randomizer is fired up. Let's see where it thinks we should go. So to remind listeners who've listened to every single episode of Season to Taste and to let you know...
Are there any?
Of course there are. Loyal listeners, there are at least...
Hello, loyal listeners.
There are at least one. And to let you know, if you're just picking up us, you know, if you were listening to Serial and you've gone, that was a really exciting podcast, what else could I do? Oh, look, Season to Taste, and I'm sure that's happened a lot. We should let you know what's left. So basically, we've got a Hartnell left to do, we've got a Pertwee left to do, we've got two Davisons left to do, we've got a Tennant, we've got three Matt Smiths, and we've got Capaldi.
Yeah.
And the randomizer hath spoken. And it has picked the statistically most likely Doctor that it could choose. It is Series 5, the first Matt Smith season. Normally I would reel off a list of episodes straight out of my head. I'll leave you to do that, Matt, because I know the first one's the 11th Hour.
The 11th Hour, the Beast Below, Victory of the Daleks, right. The Time of Angels, Flesh and Stone, The Vampires of Venice, Amy's Choice, The Hungry Earth, Cold Blood, Vincent and the Doctor, The Lodger, The Pandora Opens, and The Big Bang. And that's it, isn't it?
I think no Christmas
special.
Was there no Christmas special that year?
There was, but I don't think Christmas specials usually fall into the subsequent season. I don't know where a Christmas Carol...
I think a Christmas Carol... Hang on. Let me check the randomizer, because it does say on it where we decided to put things. I thought A Christmas Carol maybe went with this, actually, because each one had another one after it. Oh, we put the Christmas Invasion with Series 2. This one has A Christmas Carol with it. The Doctor with the Wardrobe with 6, The Snowman with 7, Day and Time with 8.
Right.
Yes, and in the way we've divided up the years for this, we even though it may not be how it's produced, we've put A Christmas Carol in Series 5.
Okay.
Or in the year as well.
Well, we won't be watching A Christmas Carol anyway, because I think it's the worst single Doctor Who story ever made.
Well, let's keep it in mind. No, we won't be watching it. It's not Christmas. And yeah. I'm going to struggle to keep all those names in my head. So, right, apart from Christmas Carol, are there any I would definitely say no to? None of them actually leapt out at me, because I have not rewatched Series 5 since it was broadcast. So I've seen all of it, obviously. I've seen The 11th Hour more than once, and I've seen The Big Bang more than once, and I don't think I've seen anything else more than once. So I don't really know what I want to go for. I don't know if I want to go for something that's going to be... I just want to just go for the best. Or whether to go for something which I wasn't too keen on at the time and give it a chance to reevaluate. Whether we want to... Do we want to do a two-parter or do we only want to do a one-parter? What do you think? I'm saying I don't want to do The 11th Hour because... Although it's ages since I saw it and, you know, Olivia Colman's in it. I have seen it twice, and I think it's the one that's almost going to be least representative of the year as a whole, because it's all about introducing the new Doctor. Okay. Although, obviously, the year as a whole is as well. And Amy and Rory.
Yeah.
Rather than being kind of, now they're settled, let's do a story.
My favourite one of the year is The 11th Hour, and then that's closely followed by The Pandora Opens, Big Bang 2 part, which I think is really good. And I think The Lodger's really good as well. There's other episodes which I think are really, really solid, like Vincent and the Doctor, like the Angels two-part story, and I enjoy Amy's Choice, and then there's ones which really aren't great. So The Beast Below, I think, is probably... It just doesn't quite work. And I remember watching that the first time.
Doesn't quite work.
I remember watching it with a friend, with you and a friend, the first time it was broadcast. And The 11th Hour was just awesome. And we were really fired up about what was going to come next. And it was The Beast Below. And we kind of switched the television off. And there was a kind of... It was kind of embarrassing, actually, wasn't it? Because no one wanted to say anything. And then we went to the pub and talked about something else.
It was just like disbelief.
It was kind of, what just happened? Did it jump the shark after one episode?
It kind of jumped the whale, didn't it?
Yeah. And then Victory of the Daleks the following week didn't really give you pause to think, well, maybe last week was just a one-off. But anyway, teething troubles and all that. And I think the season then makes a really good recovery with the Angel episodes and then is much better for the remainder. There's a bit of a dip with the Silurian two-parter.
Well, let's...
So I guess the so what of all of that is not really up for watching Beast Below or Victory of the Daleks. See, I don't like them. I don't want to watch the Silurian two-parter.
I was going to say I don't want to watch the Silurian two-parter or Victory, but I'm kind of interested... I know people do like The Beast Below, and I'm kind of interested to reevaluate it. However, it won't be... This is the next season for the Doctor Magazine Time Team. So we will get to this. I will watch The Beast Below this year with them, I think. So I might park that one. I do like The 11th Hour. I think it does the job it's supposed to do very well. And it does that interesting new plot of the Doctor meeting someone as a child and then grown up, which obviously we haven't seen before. So what does that... So that leaves us with the Angels two-parter, the finale, Vincent and the Doctor, Amy's Choice and The Lodger?
Yes.
I don't think I really want to watch Amy's Choice. Although, again, it's one I...
So you're not pro-choice, are you, really?
God. It's even the plot of the episode, isn't it? Even it's got Toby Jones, whatever that character is. I remember kind of liking it and liking that it was trying to do something different, but then not really being sold at the end. And again, it's one I could try reevaluating, but let's go for something that's just going to be fun. I do like The Lodger. I'm quite tempted by one of the two-parters. I'm more tempted by Time of Angels than anything else, I think. Because I think maybe I did see that more than once, because I think I saw the second episode in the pub, or either the first or second episode in the pub, and got there slightly late and actually missed the very, very, very first minute or two, and then was obviously in the pub watching it, so didn't always get every single bit of dialogue. I'm not sure if I then rewatched it afterwards to catch up, or if I just never did. But I'm interested in that, and I do remember enjoying bits of it, and obviously it is the return of a character we've met before, but haven't seen since.
Rory.
Not the one I'm thinking of. That would explain why it was not the one I was thinking of. So that we could have an interesting discussion about her, although we could of course talk about her at the finale. The Lodger's fun, but is again kind of feels very non-representative. Did they ever explain about that spaceship? Was that supposed to be the Silence?
It's the Silence's spaceship. Okay. I don't know why.
That still just leaves the two two-parters and the Lodger, doesn't it?
Vincent.
Oh, Vincent and the Doctor. That's an interesting one. People have very different views on that. I mean, most people really like it. And then I know some people who really didn't like it. So I'm kind of interested in that. I think I'm leaning towards Time of Angels.
If we were going to watch an episode with her in, I would prefer the finale. Just because I think it's probably the best Moffat finale. And I think it's him working at absolutely the height of his confidence and talent to really create something that wraps up the season. And
you're really right. Different. If we watch that, we can have the discussion about why you're wrong. Makes no sense. Cheats dramatically. Does really good things and then undermines them all. Yeah, no, we could definitely talk through that. That'd be an interesting discussion to have.
I don't think it does anything like the Christmas Carol, which only makes sense if you ignore every other Doctor Who story ever made.
Oh no, Christmas Carol is an attempt to ruin all of Doctor Who forever, but we're not going to watch that, so that's fine.
Okay.
Is one I've seen twice, but I suppose twice isn't that many for Doctor Who, really. Okay, let's watch...
Yes, it does. Actually, I know what bit you're talking about now in the Big Bang.
Yeah.
Yes, that is shit.
Single bit? I didn't just have one. But fair enough. Yeah, it is not perfect by any means.
No, it's not, you're right.
Well, we almost don't need to... I've convinced you already, we haven't even watched it.
I mean, the one that I think's really fun is The Lodger. But, yeah, let's go with the Angels episode.
So you wanted the finale, but you also wanted The Lodger, but you also want to do the Angels episode.
Well, I think I'm suggesting we narrow it down.
Okay. I feel like I've trailed the disagreements over the finale, and we will now disappoint the listener by not dissecting the finale, but we could do Time of Angels, or we could just go for the single episode, The Lodger, and be nice about it.
I'm happy to go for the finale, then, if you want to do it.
Let's do Time of Angels, and whatever the one after the Forest of the Cheam.
Flesh and Stone.
I always want to call it Forest of the Dead, which is obviously not that one, it's the Silence of the Library one, but always Flesh
Although
and Stone.
It is very similar.
There's a forest, and they look a bit dead.
It's basically a race through a forest to the ending.
Yeah. Okay. So, that's it. Time of Angels, Flesh and Stone. See you in 2016 to find out how that went. That is all for now.
Surely it should be see you in 2014 to see how that went. Timey-wimey.
Yeah, we can't actually do that, though. We have to follow the logic of storytelling. And consistency internally.
Yeah.
That's all sorted then, so we'll see you next time. Bye!
See ya.
Say it.
Bye.